Welcome to Iteration, a weekly podcast about programming, development, and design through the lens of amazing books, chapter by chapter. My name is John, and I am joined once again
with JP, which is me. Okay, so we are doing the second half of chapter two, A Pragmatic Approach, to the book called The Pragmatic Programmer, From Journeyman to Master by Andrew Hunt and David Thomas. And so today we're just going to quickly go through the last four tips of chapter two. And at a glance, they are tip number 16, prototype to learn. 17, program close to the problem domain. 18, estimate to avoid surprises, which I think you're going to be good to talk about since you've done a lot of that. And tip number 19, iterate the schedule with code.
Awesome. I'm excited to jump in. So let's jump into the first tip here.
Okay, so the first tip is prototype to learn. And so this sort of transitions nicely from our last episode. And so this idea of prototyping to learn is basically just like writing code that you know is disposable when you want to explore different avenues of your app. So like, it's literally like the prototyping phase. Like, have you ever just like not really known what your program or app was going to look like or what your method was going to look like? And so you just sort of like play around with things and you sort of like fuck around for a little bit and just get something to sort of work, or just so you could see like something on the screen, or so you could see like some output being displayed. And that's sort of what the idea is. And I really love this idea of prototyping to like explore things, because it's not so serious, and it's nice to be able to have code that like you're okay throwing away at the end of the day. It's not like a tracer bullet approach where you're actually writing code that is like a skeleton that will eventually grow to what your final app might be, but like just prototyping with disposable code makes it really nice.
Yeah, absolutely. I love this phase because it's like brainstorming or thrashing. You know, it's You've got the big wide marker and you're just kind of sketching, and it's a really fun and creative phase. And I feel like it's interesting you say like disposable code, because I do think that that's important, that your prototype code, like you just get reset hard and just, you know, completely erase your prototype code. I also think that we depend on code too much in prototyping. Like, one way to do it is like just HTML out the front head using your styles and just like make something clickable, but like hard link between to make sure people can use this in the way you expect. Or like some of the most insightful times I've had is doing user studies with a keynote presentation. And so like literally they have a screen in front of them and I have them like touch the screen as if it worked. And I'm just kind of clicking through a keynote presentation with different static images, because you're able to make sure you're on the right track and make sure you've got something ready. And I know that people like talk about even like paper prototypes, where it's like you put one piece of paper in front of them, see what they touch, and I'll put another piece of paper in front of them. And I feel like people kind of like look down on that because it's like not technical. But how else like can you get something delivered so easily and get that direct feedback and see the confusion on people's face and just scribble and rewrite something in a way that's just so much more effortless than even writing code? Now, of course, there's a time and a place for something like Envision or even an actual code prototype as well, because there's kind of two different things here. It's like you can prototype a product or a feature, or you can kind of prototype a backend solution, like prototyping out a method is another solution here. Or like prototyping out an API integration, like you can kind of mock a Stripe integration to be like, this is how it could work, and kind of mock that without actually going through those Stripe docs and figuring that out, just to like thrash a bit and figure it out. And I think all of that's important. It's really interesting though.
Yeah, that's true. And I was talking about this in the context of like code, but you're right. Like it doesn't have to be, it could literally be pen to paper. But it's funny because it's funny that you mentioned that people might look down on that. And there's sort of this idea that doing that is like not actual work. I think that's the perception, is that, you know, just drawing on a piece of paper, you're not like actually getting things done. However, I would argue that that's like very valuable to even just have people like go through drawings, because you're like, you're not wasting time. Like you can learn a lot about how people interact with the product without even having to like even go through the rigmarole of making like a static HTML click through site.
Yeah.
There's this like the whole like sprint methodology that's like written by like the people who at Google or something like that, like the Google sprints. I know that they like heavily advocate for using keynote presentations. Like you can fake things even more without having to use something like Envision or HTML. Like you can literally just have like a PowerPoint presentation do these things for you.
Yeah, I've actually read that book, Sprint. It's a great book. I forgot the authors of it, but it's a lot of people who are like on the Google design team, and they mm-hmm. do a lot of the design products and iterations for them and their companies they invest in. But yeah, they advocate either keynotes or pieces of paper is how they do their initial user testing when they're doing those, you know, iterative process where they discover what users want and that user research. And I do think like we're stepping our toes into more like product and user experience, but like we wear a lot of hats as developers, and that is something that we do. But I think more and more, and at least in larger organizations, those things are not handled by developers necessarily. They're more handled by like the design and product people, and then they hand back those specifications to developers. But you know, you might be on a smaller team wearing more hats. I even think as a developer that kind of prototyping things out just as like as easy as possible. If that's code and if that's the fastest way, like I'm not a very great artist. I can't even draw a box on a whiteboard very well. But you know, so if code's the easiest way, the idea is to get the thoughts out of your head and onto something as quick as possible and make something that others can interact with to get feedback as quick as possible. And that's kind of the concept of prototyping to learn. I think it's important because I know with client work, oftentimes, if I deliver something on a production server or even like a non-production server, a test server, it's very easy for clients to feel like it's done, even though if it's just like completely shitty code or if it doesn't really work, but it kind of works, they can feel like it's done. And so the book had this line that I'd like to read. And the quote is, quote, "Remind them that you can build a great prototype of a new car out of balsa wood and duct tape, but you wouldn't try to drive it in rush hour traffic." Unquote.
Right.
And I think it's really good to set that expectation. And the practice I try to use is I never put, unless it's tracer code, which is different than a prototype, but I never put a prototype on a real server that they can visit and use. I might do like an ngrok to my local host. So like a tunnel mm-hmm. to actually my computer. So it's like, oh yeah, refresh your screen and that'll change. But like that's actually hosted off my machine, be through the internet, but I don't really actually like host it on a server somewhere. Maybe I've actually sent a couple code pens a couple of times so like they can see like, oh, this isn't my site, but I'll like kind of demo out a feature a little bit. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of my line that I try to draw is I never allow prototype code to be on an actual server. That's like, I try to keep that. And I think it's been a pretty good practice so far.
Yeah, that's true. It's like, you really have to remind them like, this isn't production. It's like, but it's funny because it's like so interactive that it's easy to think like, oh, this is it. And then when you don't ship it right away, they're like, but I've already like played with it. Like I thought it was ready. So you always like definitely have to set that expectation of like, look, this is just a prototype.
Yeah. And I think that's another reason why I'd advocate for like keynote or paper, because it's like easier to be back and forth. I feel like when you show client like a clickable InVision, even at times, they feel like they can't give feedback because it's so polished. Like it feels so static. Where you get a whole different set of feedback if what you're giving them is low fidelity, because they realize it's all in flux. And I think that early feedback is really important to make sure you're on the right track. So I'm going to jump into tip 17, which is program close to the problem domain.
Do it.
This one is really interesting, and it really reminds me, it's an homage of our domain-driven design days.
Yeah.
Which is just, to me, this section was a lot of let your code be English, let it reflect the way your team talks, like use the language of the domain and try to write code that reflects your domain very eloquently. And you know, like I was working with another developer on a project and they wrote a method, the method name I stumbled across was something like execute mail delivery protocol. And like when I actually looked at the method, it was like, this is sending an email. Like, why is this method not named send email? But I think even more than that, like we mentioned this last episode too, which is just like try to, in a way, have your own namespace to projects. So it's like really clear what you're doing and how the objects all interact, and try to let your code read the way that you talk about the domain space.
Totally. Yeah. For me, this was sort of like a nice reminder that your code should be like super readable. And I'm going through Practical Object-Oriented Design again by Sandy Metz, just in my spirit. So I think it's like good to read that every like 3 months just to like remind yourself of these things. And one thing that I'm reminded of is that like Ruby programs are just literally made of objects. Like you're given some objects, obviously, like the string object or the, you know, the number object. But on top of that, like you write your own objects. And so what programs are just like these objects talking to each other. So in a way, you're like building your own domain within your program. So you're like, your program should have its own language, things like string and number. But like on top of that, maybe things like email. And then, you know, email might have methods on it like send email. And, you know, like you should be able to understand what the program's doing just by like reading these classes and not really... My note was like not really sweating the petty implementation details and like focusing on the domain problems, and your code should reflect the domain problems nicely. Like just like you said, like execute email delivery protocol is like absolutely bonkers. Like that is insane.
Absolutely. I think it's interesting too, because one of the examples, I don't remember which tip it was under, but talked about like having a DSL for a project, like having a specific language for the project, for your items to interact. And sometimes that makes a lot of sense. And so it's really just about like chaining these very domain specific objects.
Yeah. And like in a way, something like sent email would like almost be part of like your DSL because it's like so specific to your domain. Obviously that's a super like generic contrived example, but
yeah.
I'm going to jump into the next tip, which is to estimate to avoid surprises. And this, it's funny that this tip is included because it's like, it really speaks to people who are like freelancing in particular. And I think that just says a lot about like our community. Like there's like this assumption that like people, well, you know what? I take that back because this is not just about people who freelance. It's also about people who are like under deadlines and like, you know, it's like, how long is it going to take for this feature? But for some reason, my mind instantly went to like the freelance world. However, the biggest thing I took away from this is that how powerful your wording can be. For example, like if you say, oh, that'll be done in like the next quarter, that's like a very vague way to word things. Like, oh, it'll be done in sometime in this season or like in this fiscal year, or I don't know. And then so like the expectation is now like, okay, you know, that might be 10 months from now or four, like if you say quarter, oh, that'll be in the next 4 months. However, if you say something like, oh yeah, I'm going to get that done in the next 125 days, like all of a sudden there's this like expectation now that like, okay, on day 125, this is going to be done. And so like, it's interesting that you have to be super deliberate almost with like how you word things and how you set expectations, because the way you convey something will really set that expectation of when something is like going to be done.
Yeah. It's interesting how much of a difference there is between 30 days and 1 month as far as expectation of when that's going to get shipped. And that was a really good tip it had, which is like for longer periods of time, use bigger units. And he even said like about like estimates for even like super small time. He's like, don't say something's going to take 250 milliseconds. Say it's going to take under a half second. And I think it's easy to forget as developers because we are very specific and we think with that level of specificity. we think that way. And so sometimes it's really easy to try to carry that through. What's interesting about estimates, I've done a lot of estimating. I've been successful and not so successful in my stint, quite long stint as a freelancer. I think it's really important first to acknowledge that all programmers have to estimate. You have stakeholders, whether or not they're a freelance client or whether it's an internal team or a marketing person or a CEO. We all have to try to give timelines and give a reasonable scope of when things happen. It's difficult because I feel like it needs to be acknowledged with whoever you work with that estimates are estimates. They're moving targets, and that scope is a moving target, especially in the world of a startup. Like your features change and scope creeps up and creeps down and things move. And what's the other thing that's really easy to forget is for clients is that when, let's say we have project A, which is adding this feature. So feature A is being added. And then I give a delivery date of 3 weeks. Oftentimes what happens, and the reason why things are late, is because once we set that up, the next time we talk, we identify feature B and try to establish timelines for it. Or maybe they say, you know what, just push up feature B and put that in front of your work in feature A. And then feature C comes along, and D, E, E, and F. And oftentimes that feature A continues to be pushed out for months and months and months because this other work keeps getting into the pipeline. And I think it's really important to remember that when you're making an estimate, you're not making one estimate. If you have other work, you're affecting all your other estimates. Now, that could be with your internal company and with your stakeholders, or it could be with your freelance client, or it could be across freelance clients. And it's a mistake I see a lot of guys do when they're first starting freelancing is that they will make a promise to customer X and then a promise to customer Y, and those two step on each other's timelines. And it's really hard to manage all those expectations and make sure that that's happening. So it's hard enough within a single project to not have that happen. But I guess the point that I'm getting at, if I finally land this plane, is when you make an estimate, remember all the other estimates that you have out there and remember that they all affect each other. You can't make an estimate that this is going to be delivered in 3 weeks and another one that's going to be delivered in a week without considering them with each other. And I think it's really easy to forget that, and that's the thing that gets lost. And so more recently, what I'm attempting to do is try to have an estimate of hours in the pipeline across all my projects so I can kind of see, like, if I'm spending 45 hours a week doing actual coding, what am I going to get done in this next 2 weeks of sprint time? And just trying to be in constant communication with clients that when they're adding more work that's, you know, urgent or needs to be put, it's going to push those other timelines out. So if you have 10 items in the queue, that 10th item, if things keep coming before it, it may never ship. Like, who knows when that item will ship? Okay. But it's just about, like, continuing to set priorities and understanding that this all affects each other.
Okay, I have a question for you then, because... Okay, the example you said, like, you know, in a vacuum, this feature for client X might take 3 weeks, and then this feature for client Y might take 1 week in a vacuum.
Yeah.
So, like, but obviously you don't want to say this is going to take 3 weeks to this person, and you don't want to tell this person this is going to take 1 week. So, like, how do you communicate that, like, hey, to the person that, like, they know that this feature is going to take 1 week? Like, they know in their head, like, okay, the level of difficulty, I've worked with John for a little bit, so, like, he usually ships a feature like this in 1 week, but... And then you might come back and tell them, oh, actually, it's going to take 2.5 weeks. Like, how do you communicate to them that, like, it's not necessarily the level of difficulty that's affecting that estimate? It's also, like, other things, like other external factors.
That's a really good question. And so what I try to do with active clients that are open is they understand that I have a certain amount of hours to dedicate per week on their projects. So, for example, I'm managing 3 clients right now, and it's basically 5 hours, 10 hours, and 25 hours. Like, that's what I have to give to projects. And that sometimes looks like 8, 8, and 20. You know, those flux a little bit depending on their need, but they understand that I have promised that I will deliver X unit of hours. So when they're asking how long something will take, I give a range of hours back. That's generally how I've been communicating on things. So they can understand, well, I have these 20 hours of work that I want done, and he's giving me 5 hours a week. That means I can get all these issues done within the next 4 weeks. And I ask them to set their own priorities within that. So it's like, if there's one feature that takes 8 hours, that's 2 weeks timeline within the amount of work that I've allocated to that client. If they want me to allocate more work or hire another developer, we can talk about that, and then they can get things out the door faster. So it's all about staying communication, and I don't promise hard estimates on things. I give how much time I can commit and how much time things are going to take. And I push that back to them to say what they want when. So it's really giving them the option to choose what the priorities are as a client. And this system works really, really well. And I have actually a little script that goes through my open, because I do at GitHub everything. And it actually goes through my open GitHub issues and pulls in those hours across clients. So I know how much of an hours pool I have against projects. And that helps me know to be able to hire other people on a project. If I have 200 hours in the current project pool, like, I'm not getting through that for another 10 weeks. So I need to bring someone on to bring that hours pool down. So to answer your question more directly, they understand that they have a certain amount of hours per week that they've allocated, and then I'm giving estimates of man hours to get the work done.
You know, I think there's, like, something to say about giving accurate estimates, or not necessarily giving accurate estimates, because in my opinion, like, I always try to give myself some, like, padding. So if I know, like, deep down inside it's going to take 5 hours, I'm going to go back and say it's going to take 10, just so that, like, I can set that expectation and not have, you know... That way I can have a little extra leeway. But even then, I think even knowing that something truly is going to only take 5 hours is, like, such a skill to have. And I think that just comes with a lot of development time. And I guess it also depends on, like, always shipping similar things. Because, like, if you've never worked on, like, WebRTC before, like, how the hell are you going to know how many hours that's going to take you? But if you're just, like, shipping another, like, crud React app, then it's like, yeah, I know how long that's going to take me. And if it takes me any longer, then that's on me. But yeah, I think it just takes time.
Yeah, I think there's a huge distinction between like exploratory and research work and like shipping a feature that's something you've done before. And I think it's important to be transparent with stakeholders about that. So it's like, look, we don't know the best approach here and we need to do some exploratory work that, you know, I think after 10 hours of work, I will know how long it's going to take. Do you want to do that 10 hours or not? And I think it's about being really clear there. And I wrote this note here for myself, which is like, tracer code and testing helps make sure estimates are well thought out and accurate. So oftentimes there'll be implementation concerns or potentially dependencies and technical issues that you didn't foresee going into a project. And so doing those, that tracer code really helps you to know exactly what it's going to take. And more recently, I'm charging for those estimates and mockups. So it's like, if they want to explore what a new feature is going to take, I'll bill for 2 hours or so, and I will give them a better answer after doing some exploratory work and prototyping. Mm-hmm. But I just try to be super transparent about that. And it's good. And it's just good to just like treat others as you would want to be treated and just try to be transparent as possible. When you don't know something, say you don't know. Don't feel like you have to give a hard number on something, but try to give some kind of answer. It kind of comes back to like the email tip of just like, don't not respond. You have to give something and give options all that you can. So it's like, if you really don't know how long something's going to take, be like, what you can do is pay me 2 hours so that I can give you a better answer. Because some things you just have to sit with. Like WebRTC is a great example. Like me and you just had to hack on that for 20 hours before we got any traction on that project.
To even know like how long it's going to take to actually implement it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that kind of like exploratory work is a whole different category than like a hard fixed feature that gets shipped. As far as like padding stuff, I think you're right that it's important to do, especially in the beginning, because your estimates are going to be wrong. But I think the more that you estimate and track and then follow up on yourself, like I've gotten very good at knowing, at least in the world of Rails web apps, how long something's going to take me, like down to a couple hours. Like I rarely go over. If I do, it's like 10, 20%. I rarely go over on a project. I'm usually just under or right on, actually, which is good. But it's taken me two and a half, almost 3 years of doing this consistently, estimating, working over it, and like losing out the money that I could have made on that, or, you know, over underestimating projects to really land and find that. But if you're not tracking that and putting it in writing and tracking your time, then you will end up way overworking, because it's really easy to spend 20 hours on a project that you estimated 10. Because we like what we're doing. It's really, really easy to do.
Yeah, you're right. And I think the authors point out that like, if you want to get better at this, like you truly have to be tracking. That way you know like, oh, I actually underestimated, or oh, I overestimated, or oh, I did that like exactly in the time that I thought I would.
Yeah. And like just like the basics that I could give you to estimate your time, it's like if you manage GitHub for your projects, like when you open that GitHub issue for a feature, just put at the top, I think it will take this hours. Use something like Harvest or Toggle, track your time, and when you close the issue, say, it took this hours. And like just doing that practice alone, if you do 5 or 6 of those, you'll start understanding really quickly what it looks like. But if you don't write that down somewhere and have that somewhere, you're just never gonna be more accurate. Because otherwise, you're just literally shooting in the dark, and you never know if you hit it or not. You don't know if you're making or losing money. It's not a nice place to be. Believe me, I've been there. I've made those mistakes.
You know, I will say, though, it's sometimes harder, or I'd say almost different, when you have to do estimates for something like an 8-to-5 like day job, like my current place. Because if we have to like ship a feature, it's like such a loaded question to say, like, how long is that going to take? Because then at that point, it's like, well, if I was doing this correctly with like testing, it would take a lot longer than, like, my answer would be drastically different than what you want to hear. Or is it like, do I just build on top of all these broken windows and you know, monkey patch all these, you know, all the bugs that occur? Or do I like do it right? Like, so now it's sort of like this weird thing of like, well, does it need to happen now? Or like, am I being told that this needs to be shipped by X date? Or like what answer are you like really looking for? And so sometimes it's different versus like actually having to estimate like, this is how long it's going to take to do X feature. Because like, it might not just be a feature, it might just be like a slew of features. Like, how long is it going to take to get this new reporting system done? It's like, now all of a sudden, we really got to be more granular and break this down into like, it's the sum of its parts. I don't know. It's weird.
I think the nut of the question that I can answer is like, tip 7 was make quality requirements issue. Mm-hmm. So as basic as the requirements of put this blue button on the screen, the quality of that blue button and its testing against it is as much of an important of a question as the blue button on the screen as a feature. So I think it's really important to have a bar of quality in an organization. Now, I can't speak directly to what you're saying because I've never worked in the context of programming in an organization in that way. I will say, though, the other thing that I feel like happens in organizations I see a lot in companies is that that concept of like, I have made X commitment and then Y and Z comes in and pushes X commitment. And the boss doesn't realize that they have put those things ahead. Because it's like, oh, can you take care of this? Can you take care of this? Can you take care of this? But it's like, I was supposed to ship this by this Friday and I haven't touched it because you're giving me all these other little GitHub issues. I haven't even touched it. So I think that, you know, it's hard to like lift your head up out of the trees and see the forest, but it's important to do so and remember that estimates affects estimates and to be identify the quality of something. Like we've talked about, you can build a house for $10,000, you can build a house for $1 million. Like they're both houses. What house do you want? It's really, really important to try to lock that down with your organization.
I think this is like actually a good segue into the next tip.
Yeah, tip 19 is iterate the schedule with the code. I loved this because like he kept like alluding to this tip in the chapter and then he's like, we'll let you know how to give an answer to every time you're asked for an estimate. And the punchline of that is like, how do you answer every time someone says, hey, how long will it take to do X? How long will it take to do this? The answer you give every time is, I'll get back to you. And I think it's such a great answer. Like that's very, very good advice. Whenever someone asks you for an estimate, just say, I'll get back to you and get back to them and respond. But like, take some time to sit on it and think, look at past projects, how long they've taken you, see how much you over and undershot them, and then get back to them. You know, write a little tracer code, think about that, and then get back to them. But this concept of like iterate the schedule with the code. And that's what I was even saying about like how you have feature X to be shipped in 2 weeks, but then Y and Z come in the schedule. Like everything is in flux. And I think it's important to mention too, like you don't only have to move in or out your ship date. You could also move up and down the amount of requirements or complexity of the feature. And this is something that I try to do. I will estimate 50 hours for a feature and I will ship it in 5 or 50 hours, but I may scale the level of complexity in that feature. I might make it a little bit more of a simple feature. We've talked about that, but I think that iterate the schedule or the requirements a little bit here and there. I think it's important to just always be revisiting that and looking at that again.
Yeah, it's nice. Like you code a little bit, the schedule changes. Like maybe it's going to take less time. Maybe it's going to take more time. Or you write a little bit of code, all of a sudden the scope changes. Like these, like the schedule and the code are not something that's like hard coded. It's not like all of a sudden you say it, it's like set in stone. That's what you have to do. So it's like nice to have this like open line of communication so that like people know, you know, like, hey, I'm working on this, but you know, the requirements are sort of changing or the scope's changing or the schedule's like it's changing, like this malleable thing. And so just having this like open line of communication is like a nice thing to have. And I think that oftentimes it's easy to get sucked into like, oh shit, I promised this in 3 weeks. Like I have to do it. Like, you know, just communicate, just be like, hey, it's actually going to take me a little longer. There's some unforeseen circumstances that I couldn't have predicted.
Yeah. It's really tough though, because as a freelancer, I lose out on work because I'm really not willing to make hard commitments like that. Like if someone brings me a project and says, I want to build a mobile app and I want to do it in 18 weeks or how long can you do it in? I will be very hesitant to give a hard date and I have missed out on projects because of it. They're like, what? You can't commit to a date? And it's like, can you commit to a scope? I'm nice about it, but I'm very firm. That's like, if you can't nail down a firm scope, I can't nail down a firm date. And like, to say anything else is not reality. It's not reality to say, I will ship this in 2 weeks if what you're shipping is unclear or if it's not well-defined. And so it's really hard because there's a lot of tension between business people and stakeholders and the tech team. And I feel like at times, tech teams may abuse this a little bit to just every time they ask how long something will take, they'll always answer 3 months or 6 months just to like, because they've been burned so many times by like being held and chastised for their deadlines. And like, I feel like this can be like a really toxic environment at times, not even with code, just in business. It's like, you said this report would take 2 weeks and it's week four. Where is it? And it's like, that oftentimes is where a lot of this workplace stress comes from, because you committed to a date when there wasn't a clear expectation of requirements. And in software, that's exponentially difficult because computers don't understand the gist of things. Like you can't give software the gist of things. It needs to know everything to be able to ship a feature. But man, I really feel for people, and I'm sorry for you if you're out there, if you're in a company that's not willing to have an iterative schedule with your code. And that's really hard to manage. And I think that it just has to be a fundamental slow building of trust and open lines of communication of like, I'm not being lazy. It's not that I'm not good at my job. It's that code fluctuates. We iterate the project. Things are moving targets. Like that's the reality of the world we live in. We don't just like build this car and drive the car away and it's done. That's not what we're doing from a product perspective. It's not that simple. Like the product changes every day from feedback from our customers.
Yeah. And I think what you said about developers sort of taking on projects that are like at a hard deadline, like that could go either way. Like who gets burned, like the developer could get burned or like the, you know, the people like asking for it could get burned because, you know, as a programmer, you might do this thing where you decide like, okay, in my head, I know this is actually gonna take longer than 3 months, but I'm just going to take this project on anyways, kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And then like, they'll have to deal with the consequences later. And I'll have to tell them like, hey, look, what you're asking for is like, not really realistic. But it could also go the other way where like, sort of like in the other direction where it's a similar result where, you know, a stakeholder is like pushing all these new features. And it's like, well, I thought we had a scope lockdown. Like, this is why it's not taking the 3 weeks that we had initially agreed upon. And so that's sort of like the similar result, but like a different outcome of like who's sort of like pushing in which direction. And it really makes you appreciate when someone has a very clear idea of how long something's going to take and like, and what the scope of a project is, because it's very easy, I think, for eager startup founders to just like want an app. And then all of a sudden you show them something and it's like, oh, but then we have to add this. Oh, and we have to add this feature. Oh, we have to add this feature. And it's like, okay, this is getting like a little out of hand. Like all of a sudden these estimates that I've given you are like completely useless.
Yeah. And there's a lot of tension for freelancers too between like project billing, because it's, you really want to go for more of a value-based billing, but then also like being sure that your hourly is covered. And it's like, you can really burn yourself by doing project-based billing, really, really burn yourself. But then again, on hourly, like it's hard to commit to clients within a scope of work. It's like balancing these two is really difficult. I just feel like not acknowledging either of those is not acknowledging reality. Mm-hmm. And it's just a matter of continuing to communicate with your team. But I think that whether you like it or not, your schedule will iterate with your code. If your code changes, your schedule's gonna change.
Yeah. In an ideal world, it would just like always be on time and you would just know exactly how long something's gonna take. But unfortunately, that's not necessarily the reality of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Great tips this week. I'm excited to jump into the first half of chapter three next week. You want to jump into our picks?
Yeah. So my pick is, surprise, surprise, a to-do app. it's called Todoist. And I'm picking it because I'm checking it out. And I think it's just this like cool way to manage your own to-dos. Like you can add labels, it's basically a glorified checklist, but I'm trying to explore like different checklists. There's like Wunderlist, Todoist, there's like Asana, reminders app on your iPhone, but so far it's been pretty nice. I don't know. There's not really much to be said. It has like a mobile app. You can download like the Mac app. Everything's like fully integrated. So like things you add on your computer, you can see on your phone. Shit like
it's
that.
Super pretty. Simple. Super pretty. I'm looking at just their marketing site. I have not used Todoist. I am a getting things done like super nerd, and I love like checking out different to-do apps. I'm like so deep in Asana, and that's like definitely what I've picked, and I love Asana. Basically, like I live in GitHub issues in Asana. Those are the two things I live in. I'm curious though why you kind of landed on Todoist over other options, over so many out there.
Because I'm a sheep, and I saw someone I follow on Twitter say that they've been really productive on Todoist, and it was like some JavaScript developer.
That works. I like your honesty. I was at RailsConf this past week. Hey, shout out to everybody if you were there. It was so good. But I noticed like definitely was snooping on laptops just to like see what people live in. Yeah. And I kept seeing this app, Superhuman, and it's an email client, and it's just like seems so cool because it's a plain text email client. Like have you ever used like IA Writer, which is like the intelligent writer? It's like a markup editor. I really like it. It's a good, but then like they're using this email app and like you can only get it if you get an invite. And I'm like, it's one of those things. Yeah, and I really want an invite. And I like signed up and I haven't gotten an invite. But it's like, sometimes like there's these apps that you're totally right. That's like, I just am trying it because X person used it. And like, it just like kind of looks cool. But it's like, sometimes that kind of stuff's okay. It's like a different context for your brain, like a different box to live in. I feel like is good sometimes. To just kind of change things for the sake of changing things is okay.
Yeah, totally.
Good pick. It looks nice. It's basically just a to-do app. My tip is kind of a soft skill pick as well. It's Text Expander. If you've never heard of this, their tagline is Text Expander lets you instantly insert snippets of text from a repository of boilerplate as you type. So basically, it's a very, very powerful tool. I've been using it for about 2 months now, and I've been absolutely loving it. And it's free for a while, and you got to pay for it. I've been paying for it, and it's been awesome. But basically, what it allows you to do is it allows you to make these snippets, and then you can do like little shortcuts to fill out these snippets. But it does like super powerful stuff like conditionals. Like you can do these little scripts that have these conditionals. So like you can have the email start with good morning, good afternoon, or hello, like depending on the time of day. But like there's even stuffs like a form. So like I will do something like percent bug. So that's like my bug. So I'm acknowledging a bug and requesting more information. And I get a little form that pops up, just like a modal that pops up. And I actually like have a multi checkboxes. So it's like add this piece of content, add this piece of content, and end it with this. It's like I fill out this little form and then I get a nice 2-paragraph email with all the specifics that I just needed. And I have been over the past, you know, month or two, basically responding to all of my emails with only these snippets. But now that I took that extra time, like the first 2 weeks was a total pain in the ass because every time I went to reply to an email, I had to like, okay, what snippet should this be? How does that work? Does this deserve a snippet? How often do I respond to something like this? But like this week, like in the past few days, like I've been noticing my productivity. So I power through emails because like instead of like, oh, sorry, you're experiencing that bug, but like, who are you logged in as? Like, can you describe a little bit more info? Were you on the mobile app? Were you on desktop? Like all that type of stuff. I just literally go checkbox, 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 this drop down, go. And it just goes, broop, and there's the email and I hit send. And like, there's even stuff like conditionals, and you can randomize, like, I want one of these three things. So like, I have literally like an apology snippet that's like, sorry about that. Bummer. Looks like you caught a bug. And like, it cycles through these. So it's like not so robotic. But dude, it's been awesome and saving so much time and saved my butt a couple times. Cause like sometimes you'll forget to collect a certain piece of information, or sometimes you'll, you know, do certain things. And it's just like, it's nice to know that every time, like, here's the information I need. And I'm confident that the smart part of my brain took care of this. I always try to like find that stuff that allows like the smart part of my brain work for the dumb part of my brain, which is totally. Like the idea of like, I want to remember a bag of items before I leave the house. So I hang them on the doorknob because I can't leave the house without forgetting them. Like that little stuff, I feel like can go such a long way. So it's been good. I've really enjoyed using Text Expander.
Cool. I got to check it out. Awesome.
Yeah. There's other ones that are cheaper. I think Atext is only like a $5 one-time buy, not a subscription. Text Expander is a subscription. So like it's like, you got to know that this concept is valuable to you. And quick tip, OS X actually has built-in snippet support. So if you go into keyboard, you can do shortcuts, and they actually sync via iCloud. So it's actually very, very comprehensive and powerful. It does not have these conditionals I'm talking about. You can only do like snippet libraries, but still like some really cool stuff you can use with even just the built-in tools. But text expansion as a general soft skill is a really good one if you have to like do a lot of the same text over and over again.
Totally. Yeah, I think my only Mac OS snippet is the shrug emoji.
The shruggy emoji. I've got that one too. All right. Well, thanks so much for listening, guys. If you feel so inclined, we would love you to support us by dropping a review in any of the ways that you are listening to us. So whether that's in Spotify, welcome Spotify users, or, you know, iTunes or the Apple Podcast app, wherever that's at, we'd love for you to give us a review. That would be awesome because it pushes us up in search and things like that. You can find our website at iterationpodcast.com. And right there on that page, you can find me and JP's Twitter accounts. If you want to reach out, we'd love to hear from you guys. And thanks so much. And we'll see you guys next week.
All right. See you guys next time.